Okay, well, thanks very much, and I apologize for having changed the topic from the original one, but if anybody was interested, we could talk about that later. Am I talking loud enough? Is it picking up?
I'm not hearing much.
Okay. Oh. Yeah, okay. Hello?
If you put it
If it's too close, there's
outside,
something.
I think it might actually be the recording.
That's perfect. Where it is fine.
That's fine. Okay, thank you. Can you hear me then? Without.
Speak well.
Yes, okay. So this topic came up in my thesis, and so how it relates to Bill was I worked on a project with Bill concerning trying to correct a calculation to avoid violating the second law of thermodynamics near a black hole. That was a paper by Bill and Bob in 1982. And in order to study that project, I had just graduated from engineering physics, so I needed to learn some general relativity. So Bill recommended that I learn from a first course in general relativity by Bernard Schütz. So I did all the problems in the first 8 chapters. So later on, when I got to Princeton and applied math, I made friends with a Vietnamese graduate student who was actually a boat person, and he needed help with his studying for general relativity. He was actually in physics. And so I lent him all my notes, so he learned kind of from, comparing with my solutions, I guess. I hope he tried them on his own and didn't just, look at my solutions, but. And so what happened later was when I was stuck trying to find a thesis topic, and Hinn sort of returned the favor by suggesting that I talk with Bob Wald because he knew about Bob's book. And so I ended up, my advisor at that time was Arthur Whiteman, and he had taken a vacation without taking me along, so I was kind of stuck without a thesis. And didn't have a topic yet, or didn't have a thesis problem yet, but Bob was a lot more hands-on. Really appreciate that. I went to see him a few times. And the first thing he said was, "What did you do? What have you done so far?" And I talked about some very rudimentary results concerning trying to prove the spin statistics theorem in curved space-time. And I was trying to extract as much as I could from that. I didn't know how. And Bob just said, "Well, sounds good. Let's move on." And that reassured me that I didn't have to, stick with something that I was really kind of not making progress in. So, and later on, that led to looking at, the problem that he gave me, which kind of preceded finding the connection with microlocal analysis, was a problem that was thought of by, or a conjecture that was thought of by Bernard Kay. Okay, so anyway, roughly speaking, this is my abstract, and it's pretty long, but I'm sorry, it's short according to Bob's standards. He asked me to write a short abstract, so I duly obeyed him according to his definition of short. Let's see. So it started with I'm sort of reminiscing here quite a bit, so it's sort of connected with my personal process of finding the thesis problem and then trying to solve it, and then in the process of that, finding another thesis problem which I had to solve in order to solve the first one. Okay, so I was trying to resolve Bernard Kay's singularity conjecture for two-point functions of a linear scalar field on a globally hyperbolic space-time. So I'll talk about that, define more clearly what I mean by that. Oh, and if you have any questions, please interrupt and ask. I find it's a lot, but you get more out of a lecture if you actually ask a question than if you just sort of kind of let it go. You can always ask me later if you wanted to do that. So, right. First, I found, well, Bob sort of gave me a preliminary problem by email, which had to do with kind of how bad are the singularities for two-point functions. And I kind of gave an answer using Fourier transform. And then that was before he suggested working on Kay's conjecture. And I thought, oh boy, I've seen this before. It's in the literature. This looks like, you know, a lot of people would probably would already be working on this. And I had already kind of ruled that out on the basis of it was just too hard. But he said, well, try the methods you know, try the tools that you're familiar with, which were Fourier transform, tools on flat space-time. Try to solve it for a special case. So I chose the time translation invariant, or the translation invariant case, and I found, well, you can do it. So I'll show that case because it doesn't require using full-blown microlocal analysis. And so after finding that place, that result, it gave me hope that perhaps when I could find the full solution. So I started trying to go to the non-translation invariant case on flat space-time and tried all sorts of things. But I sort of, what emerged from that were a few lemmas, which I probably won't go into here. But and I kept asking people. And one of the people I asked was Abby Sofer, who was a mathematician back at Princeton, mathematical physicist, who suggested Hermander. And then I remembered that Whiteman, my advisor, had already suggested reading Hermander before, but I hadn't made much headway the first time and didn't see what I didn't really have a problem in mind either to try to solve using it. So this time I went back and studied, you know, I found the parts of Hermander and Deustermat which explicitly deal with quantum field theory and curved space-time. They actually mention the Feynman propagator and refer to DeWitt's papers. My advisor had sort of taught him everything he knew about quantum field theory, and he sort of just came up with a very general existence and uniqueness theorem for it right away using his tools, which really surprised my advisor. And so the problem was it was really hard to understand the papers, and so it seemed to take a while, but I guess with a desperate graduate student with nothing else to do except try to understand the paper, I was fortunately able to understand it and enough to write a thesis on it. Okay, so I'll talk about microlocal analysis, what it is, how the physics can be expressed in terms of this object called a wavefront set, or at least how the physics of, for example, the Feynman propagator appears in the wavefront set, and how that's like for the two-point function that reflects the spectral conditions. And okay, so I find an equivalence theorem between what's called the Hadamard condition and this microlocal spectral condition. And this was employed by other people using the rules of wavefront sets. The wavefront set is simple enough that you can apply certain rules and construct, for example, the Wick or Wick monomials as fields, and develop a renormalization theory on curved spacetime. And this was developed. This was clarified further by Hollins and Wald. Okay, another areas to which these methods can apply. And I might mention that I've been studying recently more about where microlocal analysis itself comes from, namely geometric optics. And that seems to apply to even more topics to which these methods could then somehow be applied. So it looks like it's kind of a bridge between quantum field theory and curved spacetime and also all these other areas, including WKB, you know, WKB approximation, other geometric optics methods. So it's kind of, I'm not fully seeing the whole landscape here, but it looks quite interesting so far. I also looked at applying this to quantum mechanical models, many-body quantum mechanical models, which act like quantum field theory, namely, for example, the free electron gas in a metal. And going back to curved space-time, I also was interested in attempting to extend these methods to vector and spinner models, and to also apply more of the interesting objects that come out of the microlocal analysis and the Fourier integral operator theory, such as the principal symbol, to see how that might reflect kind of the axioms of quantum field theory and curved space time. And, the way the principal symbol turns out or works out to be suggests a Lorentz invariance property for the free model, at least. So anyway, I can talk about that. That'll be at the end. Okay, so that's my list of topics. Oops. All right, so the basics of quantum field theory, just starting from scratch, more or less. You want to quantize either some sort of field, electromagnetic, scalar, or Dirac field, subject to commutation relations. There's a wave equation. And usual method is you give an ansatz for the field operator and write it as the sum of modes multiplied by raising and lowering operators. This is a Hermitian scalar field, so spin zero, no charge. Modes are given, these satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation, where the omega k is frequency, so the spectral properties is reflected there, it's showing what the one particle spectrum is. It's the upper forward mass hyperboloid. Okay. So using an inner product, natural inner product, you would define positive energy solutions, and then given the commutation relations, you can go to you sort of formally derive the commutation relations for the annihilation and creation operators. And so you get simple harmonic oscillators. So that was one of Bill's things I learned from Bill. He often, at least that's often came back to me how important the analogy was with a simple harmonic oscillator in quantum field theory. So just to mention that. In the two-point function, it comes out of that just by a calculation. And so working with Whiteman, working under him, it was, of course, not required, I guess, but I was curious about how he approached the whole thing, and he basically described, along with Gording, he described quantum field theory in terms of the vacuum expectation values of these distributional functions here, or generalized functions, right? So you have the two-point functions, you have the endpoint functions. So for the free field, you would get this particular form. You know about the Feynman propagator. That's a bit more singular because you have a sort of you need to introduce another Heaviside function or a step function to totally define it in terms of the Whiteman function, which is delta plus here. Okay, so now I mentioned the property of the Feynman propagator which propagates positive frequencies of the future, in other words, particles and negative frequencies to the past, which are reinterpreted as antiparticles going to the future with positive energy. Okay, right at the beginning, right? So now, Fourier transform, for the Feynman propagator transforms to something nice under Wick rotation, allowing perturbation theory, regularization, et cetera, to be carried out. Okay, so, and then you can deal with interacting theory. So that's just a general, it's a quick review of quantum field theory up to the point of interactions, self-interactions at least here, more general interactions as well, satisfying Weinberg's theorem. So what happens on curved space-time? Not so easy to generalize the notion of positive and negative frequencies, so you have different possible choices of which modes are of positive frequency. In some cases, it's not clear, so you make a kind of an arbitrary choice, perhaps. Different states also have different particle interpretations, so that was the work of Fulling I want to ask later your version of the story, but I'll just, from what I understand, it was that Pulling was looking into different ways of canonically quantizing the Klein-Gordon field in a flat space time, or just portions of the flat space time. So he looked at the Rindler wedge and came up with a different particle interpretation than what would be determined by Minkowski state restricted to the to that wedge. As well, Unruh came up, learned that, well, he saw that it involved a thermal, it was a Minkowski state was thermal with respect to the what's now called the Pulling vacuum, which is a vacuum of that quantum field theory just defined on the Rindler wedge. But I guess, according to your paper, Bill, it looks like he didn't think that was, he didn't take it seriously until Hawking came out with Hawking radiation. And then Bill immediately saw how it worked for flat space-time, and it came out in the 1976 paper. Okay, so Brell and Davies, of course, tells more of the story in rudimentary, summary form. Okay, also in general, you have no isometry groups, and so some of the, axioms that are useful in flat space-time especially, such as the spectral condition, which involves a Fourier transform, and Lorentz invariance, which involves an isometry group, are not available to apply to a quantum field theory in curved space-time. And so what can you port over from flat space-time in a way that's meaningful or useful on a curved space-time? Well, there's the algebraic approach. That's a possible start. I'm not going to discuss it too much here. Algebraic approach considers the algebra of the algebra generated by the field operator, or exponentiated field algebra, e to the I phi, squared with a test function, which a real value test function, I should say, that will be a unitary operator, and this will generate what's called the C-star algebra. The C-star algebra will have a norm associated with it, so you can take its closure. And a von Neumann algebra deals with closing that with respect to a variety of weak topologies, which give you the same thing. Or you can take a von Neumann algebra to be something whose commutant is itself, or its double commutant is itself, sorry. Okay, so now I'm going to stick with the Whiteman formalism here, which is very similar, the Whiteman formalism in terms of vacuum expectation values. So you would have now a product of field operators. They're smeared with n test functions, and so this becomes an n-point distribution, or a distribution on n, function of n, test function of n variables. So you get functions which are mainly smooth. Generally speaking, they're smooth except for certain point, n tuples x1 to xn subset, for which it's not smooth. So you have singularities, and so you can give a general meaning to this using the distribution theory of Schwartz and others, mathematicians. Okay, so by the way, this talk is mathematical physics. It's probably 95% math and 5% physics. So I'll try to point out where the physics is. Otherwise, I won't mention it. But so my apologies for that. But as I say, because of connection with geometric optics, the math might connect with a lot more other areas of physics, so it might be useful in that way. All right, so using the Whiteman reconstruction theorem, given the endpoint functions, you can always go back and find a Hilbert space, a dense domain on the Hilbert space, the vacuum state, the domain includes a vacuum state, and field operators, smeared field operators acting on the domain give you other Hilbert space states in the domain. And the problem here is that this operator value distribution in general is unbounded. Well, there's the Whiteman field, and there's something different called the Siegel field, which maps solutions of the wave equation to unbounded operators on the Hilbert space. And so its argument is a solution rather than a test function. So it's not clear how you peel that off in the same way that you can peel off the test functions to get a function with singularities or a generalized distribution. So so we'll just stick with the Whiteman formalism for now. Okay, so now the ingredients in a curved space-time are on a globally hyperbolic four-dimensional manifold. You have a metric whose signature is 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. That's what that symbol means. We have a Bourquer's algebra, which is a tensor product of test function spaces. These are individually tensor products of just a function of one variable, smooth function of compact support. So this can all be made rigorous. State is a dual element of the Bourquer's algebra. Usually you take the leading element, which is just a real number to be one. Okay, so that's this property here. One of the properties is positivity. It's a general requirement for a state. That's just equivalent to ensuring that the Hilbert space norm when you do the GNS or the Whiteman reconstruction is positive definite. Okay, so.
So what's the relation of the state to the ordinary formulation and the wave function density matrix? It's only that.
These are all of the endpoint functions. This is a whole list of endpoint functions. So I'll deal with later just the two-point function for quasi-free state. Pardon me?
It's mirrored in space and time, so it's not defined in the time.
It's mirrored in space and time, yes. Yeah. Okay, so you have commutativity property here. Massive or light-like particles. I won't mention tachyons, but there's something similar for that. Well, maybe up to smooth function. Anyway, I won't talk more about that. It's too controversial. So, unless you want me to talk about it, then I'll share some of my ideas. We can do that later. Okay, so specializing to the linear case and just the two-point function. So the first positivity property leads to what's called the statement that the two-point function is of positive type. And so that just means take a test function, take the tensor product with its conjugate. That's x and that's y, integrate, smear it, and you always get something positive. Here, local commutivity is if the supports of F1 and F2 are space-like separated, then you get the same thing if you just change the order. Here, Klein-Gordon equation is expressed in terms of operating with the Klein-Gordon operator on the test functions and getting zero at the end. More specifically, so the Lorentz condition is general, but in the case of of having a linear wave equation, we would like to ensure that the actual commutator has this form. So the anti-symmetric part of the two-point function should be of this form. This will automatically satisfy LC. It will be zero at space-like separation. And will satisfy the wave equation in both variables. And you have an advanced and retarded fundamental solution, which are defined uniquely up to their support properties on any curved space-time. That's the theorem of Larey-Leshnerowitz.
What's P?
Pardon me? P is the operator, the Klein-Gordon operator, Dellenberg-Shin plus M squared. ID is the delta function if you express it in terms of x and y. Okay. So quasi-free means that all the odd endpoint functions vanish and the even ones are expressed in terms of this combination of all pairs. I say all of all two m tuples such that, you know, pi 1 is less than pi 2, pi 3 is less than pi 4, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is it still working? Okay. So, and also pi 1 less than pi 3, et cetera, less than pi 2 and minus 1. All right.
Can
so,
I ask a question?
Yeah.
Why do you want the odd endpoint functions to vanish? Or is that just a property of these
things? It would follow from the commutation relations and, yeah, for the quasi-free case. It's like a generalization of the vacuums of the
because don't they compute the same point function? I know they do that for like CMB and stuff like that. Am I correct in this? Or?
Yeah, for this case, it's for a non-interacting field theory, it's just zero. Usually we take it to be that. Of course, you can consider other things with non-zero one-point function.
Quasi-free is the same as Gaussian. Mm-hmm. They're looking at the non-Gaussian. I mean, you can consider Gaussian states with non-vanishing one-point function too, but he's not doing that. But when they're doing three-point function, they're precisely looking at the non-Gaussian, possible non-Gaussian properties.
All right, so now what K-singularity conjecture is shown here. All right, so first of all, I need to define or clarify what the local Hadamard condition is. So Hadamard was a mathematician who did this very generally for partial differential equations. He found the general asymptotic expression for solutions of partial differential equations when x1 and x2 were close to each other in some sense. Okay, and DeWitt and Brehme ended up working on quantum field theory in curved space. I think it was to look at charged particles on a curved space time. And in the process of doing that, DeWitt found this paper by Hadamard and applied it in a covariant way to solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation in the curved space-time and called it the Hadamard condition. So that's where that name comes from, it looks like. According to DeWitt, I have a paper by him about his reminiscences about this whole thing. That was in 1962 or something. It was published. So the result is given here. Sigma is the geodesic distance, the signed geodesic distance squared. T is just kind of an arbitrary, it's a difference of a time coordinate function such that, you know, T of x1 is greater than T of x2 if x1 is in the future of x2. So that appears to define the epsilon prescription for this function. Otherwise, there's a good deal of freedom when you choose T. Delta to the 1/2 is called DeWitt, Moret, Van Vleck determinant, which essentially is a second derivative of the sigma with respect to x1 and then x2, and then take the determinant of that. Right, and then V is some function which is also comes from this geometric quantity sigma and possibly other geometric quantities, I guess. Pardon me?
It's called
the
fermions as well.
Fermions, yeah, you can do similar thing. Actually, I'll talk about, well, maybe not exactly the Hadamard condition, but there's work by Stefan Hollands and also Kai Kratzert, who extended the results that I'll have for the scalar case to the Dirac case. And yeah. So but one can also write a Hadamard condition down for the Dirac case, yes. Okay, and the physical report importance of this. Oh, sorry.
Is epsilon this, positive?
Yes, it should. That should be. Sorry.
What if I change the sign of epsilon or change the sign of t? What would happen?
The sign of t. Well, if you do both, I guess nothing happens in that product. But I don't know. Well, I guess it would just change positive.
Or normalizing t mu nu. We don't care what happens on the light cone. And so we just write down these formulas without that the epsilon in there at all. And there's no distinction between positive and negative direction of time in the Hadamard formula.
Okay, are you thinking of the symmetric part of the Hadamard of the 2-point function? Because that is maybe taking the principal part. I'm taking
the
full
function.
Yeah, the full 2-point function. So,
so the
symmetric plus the
so
I times the
Hadamard condition is what I would call the Hadamard condition plus another assumption about the direction of time, which clarifies
sure.
why it has something to do with Gaussian Harmonic, which I never really understood in my gut. But anyway, but
okay.
I should have forced you to educate me on this 20 years ago.
Okay, well, that's no problem. I mean, we could talk about it later more as well. Yeah, no, it's there's lots of things that I didn't understand about it myself 20 years ago, so I'm just learning now, too. And I'd like to talk about that at the end. Okay, so now the global Hadamard condition comes into play. There's a distinction now between the local Hadamard condition. So I guess the original formulation of the local Hadamard condition by DeWitt and Brehm was, there were papers by Fulling, Narkowicz, and Wald, and Fulling, Sweeney, and Wald. I think Narkowicz, the one with Narkowicz in the middle was the one which showed existence of states which satisfied the Hadamard condition. The one with Sweeney in the middle was the one which showed uniqueness of this, of, or sorry, the propagation, the effect, preserving the Hadamard condition under Cauchy evolution. Okay, so anyway, the second paper, which was much longer, the proof of the existence, and anyway, the end result was that I guess Bob, or it was pointed out to Bob that if you just assume local. Yeah, in their paper, they showed that, I guess in the Sweeney paper, they showed that the local Hadamard condition was preserved under Cauchy evolution, but not necessarily that you couldn't have some singularity coming from outside, you know, the local, when X1 and X2 were locally, were close to each other. And that singularity, you know, it wasn't ruled out that singularity could bring in extra singularities and interfere with the Hadamard condition. Make it change the form. So they had to come up with an independent assumption that not only do you have the local Hadamard singularity, but on a space-like surface in what eventually was called a causal normal neighborhood of the Cauchy surface, you would have no other singularities other than those that were generated by X1 and X2 on null geodesics. Okay, notice that this denominator is zero when x1 and x2 are null related. And the geodesic connecting them will be unique if it's in a convex normal neighborhood. And the causal normal neighborhood is sort of a thin neighborhood of the Cauchy surface such that if you take any two points in that neighborhood, you can always find a convex normal neighborhood surrounding those points, and thus you can write down that local Hadamard condition. They also, okay, this is the work of Kay and Wald, and they also made more clear, I didn't give that reference, but that's an important one, Kay and Wald in 91, they made it clear, you know, because this is an asymptotic condition as well, so that needs a bit more of a careful formulation to treat it rigorously. Okay, so now what Kay noticed through some examples was that if you, it seems that if you, normally you have the positive type condition for the two-point function. Some people call that Whiteman positivity. The commutator condition. So these three can all be generalized to occur spacetime. The local Hadamard condition, I should say. If you have the local Hadamard condition and these other two properties, I mean, that seems to be what most of the regular states look like. Then there would be no other extra singularity. So there would, the full global Hadamard condition seemed to always be true as well. In particular, also, he found states in which if you did find extra singularities, then one of these two conditions, either the local Hadamard condition, if you keep the commutator condition intact, either the local Hadamard condition, it doesn't say local, but anyway, his conjecture was under these conditions, does the local Hadamard condition imply the global Hadamard condition? Okay, question. And so he found examples by Bruce Allen, for example, and I believe Najmi and Otto Will also had examples. And he adapted that to show that Bruce Allen's examples had extra singularities on De Sitter, for states on De Sitter space, which didn't quite satisfy the local Hadamard condition. They satisfied the local Hadamard condition up to a factor, a scaling factor alpha, which was less than 1, between 0 and 1. Not equal to 1. So when that value was set equal to 1, then the singularities would go away. Otherwise, it was positive type because it was constructed as a mode sum and had the commutator property. There's another set of examples that Bernard published, and I think Najmi and Ottewell, or somebody writing a paper with Ottewell, maybe it was Deutsch and Ottewell. Also,
a few questions. This function is Hadamard representation, are they defined on the Boltzmann manifold or in the local vicinity of two points?
Yeah, well, that's the second one is the local Hadamard condition, and the first thing you mentioned is the global head. It's that second condition in conjunction with there are no other singularities.
But for example,
in a causal norm or neighborhood
there are several geodesics connecting two points.
That's why you have to you have to restrict to a causal norm or neighborhood where. Essentially between causally related points, I guess I forgot to say that. They have to be causally related points x1 and x2, and then you can find, so you can't make them space-like, sorry. So you have to keep them causally related, and then you can also find a causal normal neighborhood containing those two points. Okay, so I was a bit imprecise in my initial definition. Okay. Okay, so the end result is, just to state the result was that under those two conditions, indeed, you could show, okay, that if there is a fiducial state which does satisfy all three properties, and that was, these are the results of Bulink's Narkiewicz law to show that, then if there is a state which satisfies positive type and the commutator property, the fiducial state is mu2. If you can find an omega 2 satisfying these three properties, then it also satisfies the global Hadamard condition. Okay, so I don't have much time, so I'll just kind of skip through here. Glyn-Gordon equation seems not to be needed. Okay, so for the tempered translation invariant case on Minkowski space, the proof is you can write the two-point function as a distribution of one variable. Its Fourier transform should be a positive, it should be a kind of a positive valued measure. I treat it like a function. Mu2 is the regular vacuum, so that's well defined. You can just write it down. The difference of the two point functions is zero because the commutator is the same for both functions. Therefore, f minus f0 is real and even. Therefore, the Fourier transform is real and even. So I'm really skipping through this. But for k 0 less than 0, that means F0 is, this part is zero. And so this whole thing must be of positive type, because this is a positive function. Because of the symmetry, B is real and even, the symmetry implies that BK is positive for all K0. And therefore, BK is always zero, or always positive. So that means, roughly speaking, this is of positive type and locally smooth. And there's a lemma which says that if that's true, then it must be globally smooth, using the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. Okay, now wavefront sets. So, quick definition of wavefront sets. You have a distribution. You can take a local Fourier transform of it by multiplying by a smooth test function of compact support. And the sigma is the set of directions of non-rapid decay of that Fourier transform. You can take any coordinate system, real Rn, and this will give you the same result in the end. And as you shrink the support of the test function, make sure that it's non-zero at the singular point. If you shrink the support to that just that singular point in the manifold, then the set of directions of non-rapid decay, that means the Fourier transform doesn't decay faster than any polynomial in the Euclidean distance k. If it did, then it would be smooth at that point. But if it has a singularity, there have to be some directions of non-rapid decay. So when you shrink the support to just the singular point, you get a finite, non-empty set of singular directions. And that, coupled with the configuration space point, that's a point in the cotangent bundle. It transforms like a vector in the cotangent bundle. And that's the wavefront set. So the wavefront set is a geometrically well-defined object on any manifold. And and this is a very useful tool for describing the singularities of solutions of partial differential equations, because you have something called a propagation of singularities theorem. So the wavefront set is preserved under Hamiltonian evolution of the wavefront set vectors, where the Hamiltonian is given by the symbol of the principal symbol of the Klein-Gordon operator, which is G mu nu K mu K nu. Okay, that geodesic, the Hamiltonian flow there will just be the null geodesics. Okay, so singularities of solutions to the inhomogeneous equation will look like, there are special ones, four of them, and they can be identified with these physical objects. So there's an advanced fundamental solution. The wavefront set looks like this. The retarded fundamental solution looks like this. You have the Feynman propagator and anti-Feynman propagator, and their wavefront sets look like this. So I show the wavefront set by giving the singularity as the light line, and the wave vectors here are just the wave vectors at x1. They're forward pointing in the forward when x1 is in the future of x2, and backward pointing otherwise. And there's also a delta function singularity, which is a point configuration space in all directions of Fourier space at the origin for all of these. If you take the difference of the Feynman propagator and the advanced fundamental solution, then you get this wavefront set, and that's the wavefront set of the two-point function. So notice that all the wavefront set vectors are always forward-pointing for x1. Corresponding vectors for x2 are backward-pointing. And they're related by parallel transport along the null geodesic connecting x1 and x2. So what I got for a useful way of trying to reformulate the global Hadamard condition, I was able to show that under those necessary properties, the global Hadamard condition is the same as this wavefront set condition, and also equivalent to the condition that the corresponding Feynman propagator is of this distinguished form. In other words, it doesn't have any extra. You could always have an extra singularity where the wavefront set vector is the same all the way along the line, and that's not included. So these are special because there's a theorem by d'Oistermaet and Hermander saying that these are unique up to C infinity with respect to the wavefront sets, with respect to their wavefront sets, as long as the wavefront sets are of these four forms.
just say again what the definition of that set sigma as U was?
Sure.
It's the singular set, but what?
Singular, it's the sigma is the set of directions of non-rapid decay of the Fourier transform of phi U. Phi times U is a distribution of compact support. You can take its Fourier transform.
Non-rapid decay.
Non-rapid decay means something is of a rapid decay if for every n, the absolute value of the Fourier transform is less than or equal to 1 plus the norm of k to the power of minus n. And some constant is there. So there's some constant such that this is true for all n. There's some cn for which this bound is true uniformly in conic neighborhoods of a certain k. 5 minutes? Okay. Thanks. So that property somehow, for example, if you take a distribution which has, say, some region of where its Fourier transform vanishes, so it has some non-trivial support for the Fourier transform. If you take a smooth test function multiplied by that by the Fourier, the original function, then take the Fourier transform, you'll get support everywhere. It will increase the support. However, if you just look at the directions of non-rapid decay, those will get smaller as you decrease the support of the original function. As it turns out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. So that allows one to meaningfully define this thing called the wavefront set. Now the wavefront set for a delta function, for example, is you'd multiply the delta function by a smooth function of compact support. It should be non-zero at the singular point. This will then be just a constant times the delta function. The Fourier transform of that is just a constant function. So every direction is a direction of a non-rapid decay. So you'd write I would just write the wavefront set diagrammatically as that. Propagation. Yes?
Are you going to say more about the way you prove the global Hadamard result?
I probably won't have enough time, and
I want to ask for detail, but I just don't understand conceptually even how, when you review the result in flat space, it's kind of like a result about Fourier transforms of globally defined functions.
It is, yes.
So whereas here, you've identified a local thing, this wavefront set, whose property you can characterize. But how do you piece together all the local wavefront sets to get a statement about a global function? And I'm not asking for any detail, but just why is it even possible to stitch them together?
I guess that's a very technical question. I somehow managed to do it in my thesis. I forget all the details. It's been a long time. I'm sorry I didn't review it. So.
But you passed.
I guess I passed. So, and reviewers,
so
after many years, they eventually let me.
Does it involve, talking about a coordinate system?
I wish it were simpler. Yeah, I wish I could explain it in simple terms. But
all right, we can talk about it.
Maybe we can talk about it later, sure. I'd love to talk about it later. Or I could just refer you to my thesis. And, but I'd have to relearn some of it myself. Okay, so I had 5 minutes left. So with that, I would just mention briefly these possible applications. I mentioned tachyons before. I managed to somehow get interested in that for a while. And so studying quantum field theories of both scalar and Dirac, like tachyons, in particular applying it to the neutrino to see if the neutrino were actually faster than light. What came out of that was Kostoletsky, who wrote one of the first papers on the neutrino, the first paper, seemingly, or one of them, maybe not the original, but he wrote a paper with Hauser and TOTOS on neutrinos at tachyon. So that was in his radical days. Oops. And then he went into Lorentz symmetry breaking theories. But he let me join him in his conference in 2010. So I wrote, short blurb on that. But then when I tried to learn more about the standard model extension, where he includes extra terms which explicitly involve classical symmetry breaking, all the possible ways of classically breaking Lorentz symmetry, I kind of noticed that not much is happening with the principal symbol. So perhaps these results of Hermander and Oystermat microlocal results could be extended to these cases as well. So that's one possible manner of extending. And also Joel Feldman is a mathematical physicist at UBC who's worked in rigorously constructing fermionic quantum mechanical theories. He's now working on bosonic ones, written many papers to prove, certain models exist and work the way they should. Suggested that I, in order to try to understand the Fermi surface in, fermionic models using wavefront sets, since sometimes those surfaces get really complicated. So I tried looking at the suggested reference of Fetter and Valechka, and came up with, the easiest model is you have a Fermi gas, non-interacting, infinite volume limit, and this is the Fourier transform of the Feynman propagator. So here you have a parabola, the energy equals k squared over 2, and the wavefront set vectors, the singularity lies on the parabola. I don't know, I think you might get extra singularities on the Fermi surface, which I showed there, but above the Fermi surface, these main wavefront set vectors are forward-pointing, so that's much like positive frequencies going to the future. And for the holes, you have vectors pointing to the past. Those are the negative energy particles traveling to the past. Okay. And, I mentioned before the polarization set, where you can extend a refined notion of the wavefront set to vector-valued theories. That was worked by Kretzert and also Hollins. And I'm looking at it again because that and the principal symbol look like they're useful things for quantum field theory. Furthermore, these two objects seem to be suggested by geometric optics approximation. All right, so that's where you have you want to look at high frequency solutions of a wave equation, so you look at solutions of this form. It's an asymptotic approximation behind the screen. And you plug this into the wave equation you equate all the coefficients of tau starting with the highest power of tau equal to zero. The first order approximation is the iconal equation, and that defines the phase function, which should go in there. I'm still working on that. Okay, this is how backwards I am right now with this, but I still don't understand what exactly that is on the curve spacetime. I'm trying to do that. But Hermander worked out what this principal symbol is. And mind you, he has to incorporate an extra direction here. So because he's integrating these kinds of distributions over a parameter space, which will give him a fundamental solution of the wave equation. So the idea there is that when tau goes to infinity, you get these high-frequency solutions. They behave in a similar way as singular solutions do. Because if you think about it, how do you get a singular solution like the Dirac function? You have to add functions together with the frequencies going to infinity. So it's not surprising that the behavior should be the same. And that's one of the major themes of geometric optics approximation. Anyway, so it's interesting for me because I've always noticed that the singularities look a lot like classical photons, right? Or classical massless particles on a curved spacetime. And indeed, propagation of the polarization set reflects that as well. So you have a polarization vector propagates according to the usual rules of parallel transport in a curved spacetime, as a, you know, along an LGD6. So also for the max, for solutions of the Maxwell equation. So that seems to be kind of corresponds to the geometric, the motivation of microlocal analysis as coming from geometric optics. All right, sorry for taking so long. Thank you. Yes.
On the penultimate and antepenultimate topics, the Lorentz symmetry breaking you made by quantum mechanics, I wasn't quite sure understood what were your conclusions, or what are you asserting that the conclusions of your thesis more or less continue to apply in those two cases?
Yeah, I guess I'm conjecturing that you can apply the methods of Pomerantz-Deuschermat to construct two-point functions with positive, you know, pointing wavefront set vector, and so you can construct all these, you know, weak-ordered monomials and time-ordered weak monomials, and construct kind of like the what Brunetti and Friedenhagen did.
But now you said conjecture.
Conjecture, well,
so you,
I guess I have to look at all the details and make sure it's
so
all right.
Work in progress.
Yeah, I guess. Sure. Yeah.
And similarly for the other one.
It would also go for the tachyonic models, but yeah, for the second, next, or the last, second, the last topic, so, the fermion, so this actually, I thought that, well, you might possibly be able to, I just did the simplest case so far, so I don't think renormalization is, well, This is different because this is now a wavefront set in Fourier space, and I'm not sure if renormalization is as big an issue. I think it's already been proven rigorously now anyway. But I think what Joel's idea was to try to apply it to more complicated Fermi surfaces, which can be very complex and beautiful. And you've seen pictures of these polyhedra, which have curved surfaces and so on. I'm looking at the. I wanted to look into that as seeing if those could be described first by Fourier integral operators. And once you have the Fourier integral, I mean, that's sort of making it a lot more complicated. But then going from the Fourier integral operator to the Lagrangian submanifold and the wavefront set. So maybe that would be a way of approaching that problem and getting a different viewpoint. I'm not sure more helpful for doing what, I don't know. So some of these are methods without a problem, really.
Yes. In the space time, the wavefront sets are equivalent to the solution of the characteristics of the equation.
The wavefront sets are, yes, that's right. They're
the same.
They're called bicharacteristics. Mm-hmm. So the characteristic set is one where the.
So it's a local condition actually in the characteristic.
The characteristic equation is described by G mu nu x k. Mu nu equals zero. So the wavefront set should satisfy this at each point x. Well, x connected to y. Sorry, for a distribution of one variable, the singularities, the wavefront set singularities xk will lie in the cotangent bundle. And they must satisfy this null condition, where they have a metric and inverse metric and the cotangent vectors at that point x. So they must always be null. The bicharacteristics are pairs of points in the cotangent bundle, which are related by parallel transport along that null geodesic, and the vectors have to be tangent to that null geodesic. And there's maybe the only thing that's different, maybe that from what I did there, is that for the wavefront set of the two-point function, you have to change the sign of this vector. You just take the opposite at that point. So, I mean, the nice thing which about this wavefront set, the two-point function has this wavefront set, then you can use the rules of wavefront sets to. Okay, one of the rules is that you take two distributions with singularities at the same point, and you can never find wavefront set vectors which will add up and give you zero, then you can take the product of those two distributions. For the delta function, you can't take the square because you can always find two directions which add up and give you zero. Okay, so that's not allowed. But any distribution where the wavefront set vectors are always pointed to the future, for example, for this point, you can take that and square it, and those vectors will continue to point in that direction, or at least in the forward light cone at each point. And so you're allowed to take the square of the two-point function, which turns out to just be the two-point function of the Wick square to a factor. In the vacuum. Yeah, and so you can take all the Wick monomial powers. And then take time-ordered Wick monomials, and that gives you all the distributions you need to do Feynman diagrams and on a curved space time. So I'm sorry, I'm very weak in that area actually. So maybe Bob would be a better person to talk to. But yeah.
Yes. Perhaps we should shift questions to the last.